Do 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 do. My dear Marin, I will always remember your song, The Ballad of the Windfish. So man, I love Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening. You know, I'm sure people debate this, but if it's not the best Zelda game, it's probably the best beginner's game. Because, you know, the old NES games are kind of difficult and obtuse, and in my personal opinion, I found Ocarina of Time to be a lot more work than fun. But this brings me to another story about Zelda. So, back in my freshman year of college, my roommate had just bought an old N64 with, of course, Ocarina of Time. So while everybody was kind of precariously perched on the lofted bed, you know, watching him play and telling him where to go, I was sitting down at my desk with my headphones on, watching the Mospita and Southern Cross box sets I got off of Amazon for a non-retarded price. Now, just for the record, the MSRP on those was $89.99 for Mospita, which is 24 episodes, and $99.99 for Southern Cross, which is 23 episodes. Oddly enough, ADV eventually put both of those into one box set for $50, which is about what I paid for them, collectively. So at one point in Southern Cross, I was watching this part where two characters were going on about the red Bioroid and stuff like that. And I look back over my shoulder and see that everyone else is watching the screen and reading the subtitles. And for months afterwards, we kept joking around with it being the red or blue Bioroid, and even printed up pictures of Bioroids during class. Those were good times. So this brings me to the subject of today's Veef Show, the Super Dimension Ol Calvary Southern Cross. I don't really understand the dimensional part, because Orgus and Southern Cross both say dimensional, while Macross just says dimension, and that seems to be the common translation. Whatevs. So this is the last show in the Super Dimension trilogy, which were a collection of loosely related shows with some of the same staff shared between mostly Macross and Orgus, and some of the same sponsors for all three. Particularly, Takatoka Doys did figures for Macross and Orgus, while model companies such as Imai and Ari provided kits for all three series. I believe with Southern Cross, it was mostly just Imai and a company called LS. The production for Southern Cross, unlike the other two shows, was handled mostly by Tatsunoko, with Big West, the advertising company, functioning more as a financer. Now, being the third in the trilogy, Southern Cross doesn't get as much love as its predecessors. In fact, as far as English anime websites, the only praise I can really find for it is Justin Zavakis' buried treasure article on the Anime News Network, which I thought was a pretty good article. You should check it out, especially if you want to learn a little bit about the show. Now, I would like to talk about kind of why this might be the case, that the series isn't quite as popular as it maybe should be. But before I get into the spoiler territory, I would like to kind of preface this by saying that I think Southern Cross overall is a pretty enjoyable series from the beginning of sort of that heyday of sci-fi mecha shows. While the conflict of man versus invaders is a little basic and obviously was done before, not only in Macross, but in obviously Orgus a little bit, and of course Space Fellowship Yamato, and shows copying it, and really any kind of super robot show before then. I think the cast is very quirky and energetic, the robots are pretty neat, and there's enough little twists in the conflict that make it interesting. If anything, it doesn't suffer from the biggest problem with Macross, and where some of the episodes just look absolutely god-awful. So yeah, this show actually does have a pretty even look as far as animation quality. And I think that goes a long way to kind of letting the show age a little gracefully. So the basic setup in Southern Cross is that it's half past the future, and the French apparently have won because everyone in this show seems to have a French name. And on the colony world of Glory, they are protected by the Army of the Southern Cross, a collection of dudes and dudettes in armor whose organizational charts exist just to pad out model kit instructions. Some of the armor looks vaguely samurai-esque. Some of it looks a little bit more European. And if you ever checked out Roger Harkavy's The EMI Files, you might have seen that originally the show was meant to be a kind of a sci-fi Sengoku-era Japan story, which is where the whole armor thing comes from. They did manage to kind of genericize the armor, so it didn't kind of look super, you know, Japanese-y. But still, I do think it's funny that almost every character has kind of a European or French name. So, in a move that would really make the guys at Team M really happy, the show features a female protagonist named Jeannot Frances. And she's actually voiced by Sailor Mars herself, Michie Tomizawa. And this actually, I believe, was her debut appearance. So this show didn't actually ruin any careers. Actually, it started a couple. I recall that Hiroyuki Kitazume, the guy who would go on to do a lot of animation for Sunrise and like Zeta Gundam, Double Zeta, he did character designs for Shaw's Counterattack. He was also working to adapt some of the rather lolitastic original designs that were made for this show. If you actually do have a copy of This Is Animation Special Southern Cross, you can see these early designs, and they remind you that this kind of stuff existed, you know, for a very long time, and is not a recent thing with the Moe phenomenon. So, Jeannot, unlike a lot of girls in mecha shows, she actually acts like you would expect her to. She likes to go shopping, she likes to put on pretty dresses, and antagonize her subordinates. She's still handy with a beam rifle, and is the best pilot out of Squad 15. And the thing that I really like about her, not so much her massive blonde afro, is that everything she does really feels very natural. Like, yeah, she goes from commanding dudes and transforming hover tanks to taking many, many shower scenes, but it never seems out of character. Her time in the shower is some of that really early 80s fan service that people love. If anything, it makes her hair look a little bit better because it's not up in the blonde afro when it's wet. And if you really want to play a drinking game with this show, just take account of how many times they frame a scene with Johnny's perfect little bottoms. By the fifth episode, you'll probably be deader than Carl Masek. I mean, you'll be less alive than Steve Jobs. Well, never let it be said that I won't go for the easy jokes. The rest of Squad 15 is a fun bunch of screw-ups. There's Andres, who tries to be the smarmy asshole until Johnny kicks him in the shins, repeatedly. For the tech guy, they have Louis, who is a smarmy nerd with a saucy frock and 80 shades. And for the lulls, we got a smarmy womanizer named Charles. He used to be squad commander until he slept with the general's woman. Oops. And then we have Bowie, who is not smarmy. Probably because he's actually played by Hikaru himself, Arahiro Hase. The poor guy got really typecast, even after just like one or two roles. Bowie's whole deal is that he's kind of a reluctant soldier who would rather be playing piano than splitting Xeno skulls. Kind of a stock character, but one who was pretty well done, and he's really almost the breakout character in the whole thing. And now, because every party girl needs a snotty bitch to keep her in line, we have Lana Isavia. And she's, of course, voiced by Mika Doi, best known for her roles like Misa from Macross. And, of course, her breakout role, the titular character from Angel Cop. As an officer of the Glory Military Police, she's put down the no-fun sign when Jeannot acts up. Also, being part of the GMP means that she basically does anything they need her to do, like search and rescue, which I guess they might do when military police, and also serve coffee to the officers. It's like, yeah, woman! Give me my fucking coffee! Honestly, out of all the three girls who are the kind of the main characters in the show, she's my favorite. I like her bushy blue-green hair and matching blue uniform. And for the first, remember the first time I watched, I forgot that whether or not she actually appeared in her armor, or arming doublets, as they call them in the show, because I thought they were felt like, well, her hair is too big to fit inside the helmet. But early on, you kind of see her on like a video screen where she is in her armor, and then in like the last two episodes, she is in her armor. Pretty much it outside of the opening sequence and the eye catch. The model kit for her was actually kind of infamous because, unlike the other model kits, hers came with an alternate bare chest showing off some really ugly 80s plastic breasts. And this is actually shown in the commercial for the Southern Cross model kits, if you can find it on YouTube. Yeah, so a lot of people just kind of remember her for that, and there is out of all the characters, she gets the most fan art because of, you know, that. And because this show for 10-year-old boys needs more strong female characters, the main cast is rounded out by Mari Angel. She's a cool customer. She has a reputation as kind of a bit of a man-eater. Her nickname is the Cosmo Amazon. And her subordinates kind of fear her. And really, the girl loves to flaunt it, too. She was totally showing off the goods while she was wearing that hospital bathrobe after being shot down. So, and one thing I noticed is that all three girls are lieutenants, or at least Johnny becomes a lieutenant very quickly in the course of the show. I mean, so there's Lieutenant Johnny, Mari, and Lana. There's Lieutenant Brown at one point, and there's even a Lieutenant Wong.
Balls!
Okay, no one's going to get that joke. So in between kicking alien ass, there's some shopping. One scene I like in particular is where Jeanne is on patrol, but she decides to go inside a dress shop and look around. So she spots an 80s-tastic pink dress. And Mari comes in, she's off duty, she has a subordinate with her, and she's like, "Hey, scrub, buy this for me." And the guy's like, "I can't afford that." And Jeanne is like, "No way, that's mine." And then Lana comes in and tells them all to go back to work. So they all leave except Lana, who actually holds up the dress and, you know, gives the full moe smile because she likes the dress so much. Clearly, this is riveting entertainment for boys on the cusp of puberty. I mean, someone had to buy all those smutty OVAs that came out after the show. Not just Southern Cross OVAs, I mean more, you know, like Megazone 2-3 and Cream Lemon, of course, and Campus Special Investigator Hikaru-on. Don't get me wrong, it's not all makeup and dresses on Glory. No, no. The planet is being invaded by huge, brick-like spaceships that hang in the air in the exact way that bricks usually don't. These are the Zor, a powerful alien race who are so mysterious that the good guys manage to guess their name by episode 2. With their massive ships, the Zor have near complete air superiority, or at very least they're very good at shooting down the multiple different kinds of fighters that totally don't transform at all. For their more toyetic forces, the Zor have these things called bioroids, which are more regular humanoid robots. Maybe this is where they got that name for Appleseed. Masamune Shiro, were you a Southern Cross fan? So Bioroids ride around on Bioverse, and they get later replaced by Biopsychers, who ride around on Bioverse. There's kind of a lot of bio going on here. I think there's a bio laser at some point during the show. And their pilots are Biohumans, who despite being brainwashed for combat, still feel the need to flick their perfectly conditioned 80s hair, you know, as if they are, you know, just beautiful young men. Now, the big twist is that the captured humans from Moonbase Alus are the ones who became biohumans. You see, the Zor feel that they are kind of mostly above combat and feel that they would rather just use captured enemy soldiers to pilot their robots. And actually, Glory has two prominently displayed moons, which you've seen a lot during the show. And I'm sure that having two moons never caused trouble for anybody. So, despite the constant and really obvious evidence that the Bioroid pilots are in fact human, the show's resident asshole general, Claude Leon, decides to wipe all of them out, you know, and even though his whole kind of overarching plan throughout the show is basically, well, they keep nearly wiping us out every time we fight them, but if I keep sending main characters in there, maybe they'll accomplish something. And, you know, looking at this guy, he's, you know, kind of a big bald guy. I gotta say, he sort of reminds me at least of Bruins head coach Claude Julien. Although I would much rather trust Claude Julien's leadership than Claude Leon's. Alright, so obviously there's a lot of cool robots in this show over the course of the 23 episodes. The main one is really the Spartas, which is a transforming hover tank. Some people complain about the design because it actually has an exposed cockpit, kind of like an old Jeep or really, it was sort of meant to be, in the early drafts of the show, kind of a battle chariot. Really, it's kind of a cool design. It actually does transform into three different modes, a sort of a gearwalk, sort of hopping tank turret thing, with one big cannon and one little cannon that is stored in the arms. Yeah, that's actually cool. They actually do really hop when they're in this mode, and I like that, because, you know, gotta fight on the bounce. And they transform into a more typical, heroic-looking robot with very normal proportions. I think I figured that after Orgus and maybe Mospita, that they felt that they needed something a bit more, like, actually, you know, heroic looking, because, like, the Orgus doesn't quite look like your typical hero robot. You know, it's kind of got wider shoulders, the proportions are a little bit off. Talking about this with my buddy Aster Pollinizer, I pointed out that in, like, one scene in the opening for Orgus, it's actually drawn a bit more humanoid you know, with kind of shoulders a little bit more closer to the body. And also the Mega House Palm Action Orgus toys are a bit more humanoid in their proportions as well. I mean, I shouldn't say humanoid, but more human-like, I should say. So the Spark Twist is actually, it's pretty cool, I gotta say. I mean, it animates well. It looks cool in combat. It has a little energy rifle, too, that it carries around that it can shoot stuff with. You know, they do the William Shatner-approved dodge roll, you know, just like any good giant robot. Honestly, I'd say I would totally buy a toy of it. But I will get into some of the issues with merchandising with this show a little later on. And because they kind of needed to have, of course, a transforming jet to sort of go with, you know, Makarov, obviously. Orgus, it was a little bit tenuous, the transforming jet thing. Mossopedia obviously had to have a jet put in the show to kind of please the sponsors. Southern Cross has is that first they have the Logan fighter, which kind of looks like a cross between the Thunderbird 2 and a VF-1D Valkyrie from Macross. And, oh, I have my hounds. Maybe I should have taken off their collars first. They're going to start playing around. I apologize for some of the noise in the background. That's just my dogs being silly. Oh, so anyway, the Logan. I got to say, despite the fact this is easily the most toy-friendly of the designs, it's kind of awkward looking, and I think they knew it too when they were trying to draw it, because it never really looks quite cool when it's flying around. I still think I have the clip of it on my YouTube page. Unfortunately, like I said in the last episode, I'm kind of getting totally fucked over by Japanese companies who are afraid of having their content in an American-hosted website. Although I noticed for like Kamen Rider stuff, they still allow like mad videos from Japanese people, so I don't know. Maybe they're just afraid of the gaijins having it. But yeah, so in this one clip, and there aren't really that many more clips of the Logan in the show, but it doesn't look super heroic, you know, as it's flying around. The big problem is it's got this really big kind of upper body with the cockpit area, and then just kind of a regular robot body put underneath, so it just looks very top-heavy and not very cool. I did have a clip of the Auroran, but those guys at Topless Robot used my clip for their article about Macross versus some other show, so I took it down kind of as a fight against them. Actually, at first I changed the title and put in some annotations, like making fun of them, but whatever. Yeah, so the Logan wasn't that good, but what they eventually follow up with is this kind of cool space helicopter thing called the Auroran, and you never really see it in helicopter mode, which it has. We see it more often in the robot mode, which obviously have the helicopter blades on the back as kind of a vernier pack, and in a kind of space fighter mode, but you know, it still looks like a helicopter even in space fighter mode, because it's got the tail, it's got the helicopter fuselage and tiny little stub wings. It's like, it's a freaking helicopter. Not that I'm saying being a space helicopter is a bad thing, but because, you know, my favorite show has freaking space F-14s. So, you know, just saying, it's a space helicopter. Learn it, love it, accept it. But yeah, it's a pretty cool robot. The transformation, I will give them credit for it. I don't really know how it works, but they did do two different stock footage sequences of it transforming. So there is definitely a feel that they knew how it transforms, even if I don't know if there's line out of the transformation sequence, but you know, just kind of freeze frame and maybe you'll figure it out. It's an alright, it's kind of a cool design. I mean, it's somewhat VF-1 Valkyrie-esque, but not really. It's definitely shows its roots as kind of a samurai robot, more so than the Spartus, I would say. And yeah, so this kind of filled out the show, but they really never actually made model kits, because at this point Takatoku Toys was in deep trouble by 1984. I mean, they couldn't actually even release friggin' Galvion toys, at least under their own name. All the Galvion toys got released by questionable sources, and the big deluxe Galvion toy was just put in a plastic bag with a header card that didn't even say Galvion on it. Released by some company called Toyco. I'm not sure who they were. And there was another company called Mark that did these smaller Galvion toys, but they changed the heads and gave them new box art and released them as different toys, which were imported in the Converters line in America. So, you know, that's kind of how it works. I guess there really wasn't any work being done on any kind of Southern Cross toys. There were supposed to be models of a lot of the background robots in the show. These things are kind of like the Destroids. They're just kind of there to fill screen time. They were intended to kind of show that each division of the Southern Cross military had their own robots, but for the most part, we just kind of see this one called the Salamander, this one called the Gotham or Golem, I think it's supposed to be Golem. It's actually a autonomous police robot, which just spouts regulation the first time we see it. There is a lot of cool stuff in the show. I mean, at least to keep you happy as far as being a mecha head. I have to say, probably one of my favorite scenes as far as like the mecha go is that later on when they replace the bioroids with these biopsychers, which are kind of improved bioroids piloted by the Zor themselves. A biopsycher jumps off a building, jumps on top of a Spartus, and then crushes it like a Goomba. It's like, oh, it sucks to be that guy. He just gave that freaking biopsycher an extra life. So as far as the main plot of the show goes, again, it's kind of standard because it's the whole invasion by aliens thing. But, you know, I like that the whole twist that the aliens are using brainwashed humans to fight their battles, which kind of sets the Squad 15 particularly, kind of uneasy. Because they don't want to shoot people that, hey, that they might have known at one point, or just innocent. I guess most of them were soldiers, because they're from the moonbase Alus, you know, who are just are fighting against their own will. Janu actually finds out that the pilot of this bright red bioroid, which I believe was either called the Soul Bioroid or the Zor Bioroid, at least on the box art, is piloted by this mysterious and very pretty man who has purple hair, and again, he's the guy who flicked his hair nicely even when he was still under mind control. And, you know, they kind of foreshadow this, that Janu is kind of looking for, you know, her. She is a young girl of 17 years old who is dreaming of her prince one day, and what better to have a prince than a mysterious man in a big red robot? You know, it worked for Shara's novel. So eventually they find out that, well, first they, while attacking a downed Zor ship, because the Zor ship came down to Earth came down to Glory for some reason. Glory is totally not Earth. Nobody should ever convince you that it is Earth. So they actually managed to take down the one of the battleships by shooting the core, you know, trench run style. So after the squad bumbled their way through the interior of the enemy battleship, Janu manages to clothesline a bioroid and capture it. It's like, damn, girl, you know a couple of good wrestling moves there. And so they take it back and they examine it and find that bioroids are controlled by the pilot's mind. They are basically hooked up to the robot and kind of act as its brain. They sort of sit inside in the fetal position and then just kind of let their brainwaves control the robot. And because of the way the things are built, they're very hard to kill because they kind of have artificial musculature, you know, nervous system, all that kind of stuff. So they are a dangerous enemy, and this is where we kind of see the first apprehension, because now they know, or at least they know for sure, that the pilots are just human beings who have been modified and brainwashed. Actually, though, for whatever reason, the scientists and Claude Leon decide they're just going to the pilot already died, but they're just gonna, you know, incinerate him and not actually do an autopsy or anything like that. It's like, no, this is a Zor. This is what we're fighting. We need to kill them. I was like, oh, okay, you know, you're just military dudes being wrong, I guess. That's kind of all you guys are really good for, is being wrong in these mecha shows. You know, honestly, I've rarely seen a mecha show where, like, the military at large are, like, right. Yeah, because like, I keep thinking back to in Macross when Misa and Captain Global go to the UN headquarters, and they're not really met by the UN leadership directly. They're just met by a bunch of guys on giant, like 50-foot tall, I don't know, holographic whatever screens. And it's like, you know, with the HD technology of 2009, I can imagine that when your face is, like, you know, as big as a giant robot, you can probably count all your nose hairs by that point. But, you know, they're all, like, you know, dismissive of everything, and it's like, yeah, these guys are wrong, and, you know, the audience knows that they're wrong, and, you know, it's like, well, the military at large is always just wrong in these shows. It's always, you know, just, like, the one guy or the smaller subsection that actually do know what's happening because, you know, they're smart and not stupid like Claude Leon. So, but eventually, when they're fighting the Zor battleship, it's still on the ground, and as it manages to take off with the help of another Zor ship, this red bioroid is hit by, I remember this, a bio laser, which causes it to crash, and this is where Lana does her search and rescue and finds Siegfried Weiss, who is the pretty man with the pretty purple hair. And Siegfried has, because this is, you know, fiction, he has amnesia. He cannot really remember anything outside of some traumatic scenes of, well, him being born, I guess. Like, scenes of him as a baby, I'm not sure what those are there for. And scenes of him being on Moonbase Alus as it has been attacked by the Zor. And he keeps trying to search and search for, you know, the secret to his memories. But the real reason that he was seemingly betrayed by the Zor is that they are using him as a spy. Unknowingly, because his brain has been modified with transmitters that they cannot detect. So that wherever he goes, he just... Sometimes he kind of, like, stumbles around and doesn't know what he's doing. And at one point, he's just kind of sitting around watching the rockets go off as they're ready to attack the Zor in orbit. I was like, so nothing suspicious about that at all. You know, they gave him free range to recover his memories. But the thing that I like the most is before they turn him over to Squad 15 to regain his memories, Janu and the game decide to go and find him in the hospital. He's being under heavy guard on the top floor. And the whole plan is just so delightfully kind of goofy, but it's really fun because what they do is they dress up as like maintenance people and they sneak in and it's like, you know, it's all right, you know, it's Japan or it's space France, so you know that as long as you look like you know what you're doing, they let you go through. But, they get in and Louis taps into the phone lines and they have Boe speak as if he's, you know, to call Lana away if there was an emergency. And I like that he actually like holds his nose to do that, you know. I'm talking on the phone trying to sound important thing. You know, it's like, that's just great. And then Andres goes up to the top floor and he's, you know, pretending to be some guy looking for his girlfriend or something in a bathrobe. And Janu is dressed up as a leggy nurse, much like the one in Animaniacs. And at one point she does climb up the side of the building and we got a very nice panty shot of, I think they were either heart panties or polka dot panties. And she busts in, and this is the whole scene where it's like, are you the red bioroid? What's the red bioroid? I don't know what the red bioroid is! Yeah, you know, it's just kind of a fun little silly, maybe 80s action sitcom kind of scene there. But really what I do like about this show is that all the characters, the main cast especially, is that they all feel like friends. I mean, they feel like real people who are genuinely, you know, like to be around each other. You know, there's that sense of camaraderie. Even with characters like Mari and Lana, there's a friendly rivalry with them. So, you know, it feels pretty good. I mean, the dialogue's pretty good. I really can't say there's a lot of stuff that the show does bad. Really, because of the way the plot develops is that eventually they do go onto a Zor ship while it's still in orbit. And Seyfried is once again brainwashed, so he betrays them. But as they're looking for Seyfried to rescue him, they stumble upon some actual Zor, and the Zor themselves are, well, like most of these shows, they are just humans with funky hair colors and rough. They are humans with kind of funky hair colors and sort of pale skin. The odd thing about them is they all exist in triplets, sometimes fraternal, sometimes identical, but they are all triplets, and they live kind of in this kind of malaise. They just sort of walk around wearing their, you know, space jumpsuits and, you know, sci-fi robes, and they don't really do much, and they're supposedly their emotions are repressed, but I find that despite trying to pass themselves off as being, you know, evolved beyond emotions, they do tend to, you know, raise their fists in anger a lot. And they get annoyed, and, you know, they get angry at times. That's kind of the whole thing. But Boe finds one girl whose name is Musica. And because he is a musician himself, and because in both Mospedia and Southern Cross, they kind of push the music angle a little bit more. In Mospedia, it's kind of bigger in Mospedia than it is in Southern Cross, but, you know, they kind of use this as sort of the cultural connection that we have with these aliens. And Boe obviously falls in love with this beautiful young lady, and she falls in love with him. Because, oh, he is a human, and he has emotions, and he cares for people. He feels so warm, and, you know, all that stuff. So eventually they do rescue Seyfried. He learns more about his memories. As they're attempting to, like, kind of erase his memories, they kind of dump everything they need back into his brain, and then they rescue him. So he's kind of running on all four cylinders at this point. And they do take Musica with them. And this is much to the chagrin of her two sisters, Musiel and Musier. They kind of have weird names. Because Zor, who have lost one of their triplets, are considered to be part of the unfettered. And they are not considered to be, you know, a viable part of the society. And they're just kind of put to standing around in a room and play with polygons on a computer screen. Or eventually some of them just get turned into organ donors. You know, they just get put into vats and used to grow organs for other Zor who need them. But one of the big problems with the Zor is that, I forget if they say this in the show or it's more in the show notes that come with the DVD, but they are actually the original inhabitants of Planet Glory. And they went away a very long time ago, and they had used this plant called the Protozora, which also exists in kind of trinities themselves, to give themselves bioenergy, which is what they kind of live on and use to regulate their lives and their emotion. And the problem is that they are running out. I mean, they do mention they found some more Protozora on another planet, but they need to go back to Glory, where there are ruins, where they exist on these big three mounds that have Protozora that are thriving, so they can, you know, have these, get these plants and continue to live on as they were. And part of the problem for them is that they're, again, running out of energy. They're starting to kind of get more sluggish, kind of die off. It does kind of get to the point where towards the end of the series, they are abandoning their own people and their own ships. You know, just trying to kind of consolidate what resources they have and eventually take over Planet Glory. And here's, you know, obviously the big conflict is they feel like they are above humans, they cannot live with humans. But, you know, people like Bowie and Musica prove that they actually can get along. And it is through Musica's song that she knows from a long time ago that they find out kind of the secret of these plants that they found. And this is where Siegfried has his big revelation that, oh my god, my life was pretty much ruined by the Zor, all because of these plants. You know, my life has been, they messed with my brain, they, you know, turned me against my former allies, all because of these plants. And he just gets this dark streak. There's kind of a darkness to that character that I kind of like. You know, he's got this tortured background that doesn't feel too overwrought. And Jeannie keeps trying to, you know, reach out to him, and, you know, she takes him to the carnival at one time, and they have, like, hover parks. A lot of stuff hovers in Southern Cross, I noticed. A lot of hover cars, hover trucks. They do have regular APCs and Jeeps, which is kind of weird. It's like, I figured they'd have, like, hover APCs and hover Jeeps. I think that was just because there were a couple of different designers working on the show, so they kind of didn't have quite a unified vision of how everything worked. But yeah, at some point he kind of gets part of his memory jogged because, for whatever reason, the hover roller coaster thing wasn't quite up to standard, and Jeannie goes flying out of it, but Siegfried, being the badass he is, manages to catch her before she falls to her death or something like that. But yeah, he's a fucking badass. So really what ends up happening is Bowie goes AWOL for a while, and this does cause some strain because his father is Bowie Emerson. His father is General Rolf Emerson. And, you know, he does kind of have a chip on his shoulder because, you know, he does have to be constantly compared to his father and, you know, is told that when his father is going off to fight the Zor that he might die out there. And he's all like, well, I don't care about my father. That's like, yeah, sure you don't, Bowie. Squad 15 does track him down. Lana's after them too. But they convince Lana that she doesn't have to prosecute them because, you know, she was informed of Musica's presence by Siegfried, who had said that she was a Zor spy. And Lana's obviously, you know, very on edge about the whole idea of Zor spies. Because there was some mistrust of Siegfried, obviously, at many points during the show. And what really happens in the end is that the Zor are kind of on their last gasp, and they've sort of also pushed the armor of the Southern Cross to their limits, and they've started threatening many cities of Glory directly. Although it's kind of weird, because we don't really see that many other cities on Glory, for the most part. You know, there's just kind of like, here's this one city, and, oh, they mention some other cities at some point. Yeah, you know, it kind of gets to this point where Siegfried actually kind of holds the ruins ransom and says, you know, that I will destroy these flowers if you don't negotiate with me. And he uses this to kind of get them to come down and really just to get to the Zor leader, Dess, who is the one who brainwashed him, and he feels the need to get revenge on them. And during this whole escapade, once again, on the ship, they kind of try to do a prisoner exchange between Mari, Lieutenant Brown, and General Rolf Emerson, who got captured during the battle in space. They take Musica away, but they do rescue her eventually. And unfortunately, General Rolf, I mean, kind of big surprise, he does get fatally wounded. And of course, with his dying breath, he does look at his son, Bowie, and says to him, "You too, you and Musica are the proof that we can live together, and that we will go on," and, probably dies after that. I do love the whole cliche where Bowie says to his father, it's like, Dad, you're going to be okay. And I just wish he had said to him, "Son, I have a baseball-sized hole in my chest right now. I don't think I'm going to be home for dinner." Also, I guess I forgot to mention that Bowie is actually clearly of African descent, or I guess he's whatever passes for a black person in anime. He doesn't have big lips or anything like that. He's kind of got a bit of a pompadour. But his father is white, and I'm sure this didn't confuse anybody at any point. I like what my friend said about this, is that she had said, well, maybe General Rolf Emerson is just kind of like, he's black underneath, but his hands and face are white, like he has a disease or something. But it's like, no. Oh, boy. Eventually, they kind of managed to kind of escape, because I actually like him one point, because Charles comes busting in with his Spartus, and he makes it transform. And he actually, I'm sure this scene got cut somewhere in some version of the show, but he actually swats somebody with the Spartus, one of the Zor soldiers, unarmed, with a Spartus, the big robot hand. It's like, ooh, that nasty. So Janu has run off after Seyfried, who's again, he went back to his bioroid, which I guess they had somewhere, and is looking to kill Dess. And he kills one of the Zor leaders, and eventually goes after Dess, who's trying to get to an escape pod. During this, there's a little revelation about how, the cryptic message about how the protozoar will help the Zor stabilize and live forever, and, all that jazz, but, whatever. And Janu manages to catch this one protozoar containment vessel, and she goes in this kind of trippy dream sequence where she sees herself as a part of a trinity, and then she sees a little girl with flowers coming up to her, going off to a bunch of parents, I guess, and they don't really explain what this is all supposed to mean, but I heard there was some weird interpretation of it by somebody else. But yeah, that's just kind of a little scene where she declares that she is a human and not a Zor, and whatever. So as Dess is going off to the escape pod, Seyfried follows him, and, Jeanne is like, "Don't kill him!" And of course he kills him. And she says, it's like, "What you just did isn't going to save anybody." And Seyfried says to Janu is that, "This is something I just had to do." And then gives her, I guess this is kind of the stun kiss. I'm not sure how he does this, but he just kind of kisses her, picks her up, and then puts her in the escape pod. She doesn't kind of snap out of it until, she's locked inside. And then he goes off, and using his bioroid, he blasts the core of the enemy battleship. Just because what had happened, it was actually on a collision course with a central city, the main city on Planet Glory, which was kind of the last stronghold for humanity against the Zor. And everybody gets off the ship, Janu survives, and there's some Zor standing around, and pieces of the ship go and crash into the ruins and scatter the petals of the Protozoa all over the place. And it's just kind of a... This is where people talk about how the show was, in fact, canceled because it wasn't quite as popular as they wanted it to be. Now, people actually use this to kind of detract against the show, but I think the ending, while it is kind of a little abrupt, it isn't quite as, or maybe a little bit truncated in some ways. I feel like they kind of covered everything they needed to, as far as plot points. Talking with Jeremy about it, he said, well, my concern was just that they had shown a bunch of Zor ships, circling the Earth, and they're still there, presumably, at the end of all this, but, I believe we're meant to imply that because they're running out of bioenergy, that they couldn't really operate their ships effectively, and they would eventually, I guess, maybe starve or die out or something, or they just kind of go into a coma. I mean, one scene that they do show is that people they could no longer sustain, they just kind of started to jettison them into space. It's like, ooh, that's a little dark. But, we don't quite get the full, you know, encapsulated ending, like, you know, this is, you know, how everything worked out in the end. It's kind of left on a bit of a cliffhanger. I don't think it was really that bad, you know. Again, people say that, you know, Southern Cross was canceled, but I believe so was Mospita. I mean, when I talked to the author of the Emi Files, that collection of pre-production drawings for Mospita and Southern Cross, S founded an old office for the Emi Model Company after they went bankrupt for like the 10th time. Was that the designs in the Mospita section were the ones that weren't good enough for a show that got canceled due to not being popular. So I do believe that Mospita was shortened, not as dramatically or, you know, as obviously as Southern Cross. You know, I don't think they were kind of in the same boat as far as their reception with the Japanese audience. Actually, Mospita had the problems that at the same time as running against Dorvac, which aired, you know, 4 days after Mospita started. And so these two shows were kind of running back to back, and, you know, the sponsors were kind of split between the two shows. There wasn't quite as much cohesion between the two. And in the end, Dorvac lasted, you know, like 36 episodes, I think. Mospita was only 25. So I think it did better, or at least there was more money put into it. So that's kind of how, where we were when Southern Cross came around. It was like, well, because Orgas had finished in about the middle of 1983, and then Mospita and Dorvac, they're not actually Super Dimension shows, Mospita and Dorvac, but again, some of the same sponsors were behind those shows that were behind Orgas and Macross. So, but they started airing in October, and I think there was kind of almost a bit of a sort of two-way, sort of maybe three-way Transforming Robot clusterfuck. I mean, not counting the other shows that were around during the time. And as we saw with Southern Cross, it came out in, it started in April of 1984, sorry. And it ran until September. And between this, there was all the buzz for Macross Do You Remember Love, which kind of proved that people didn't want to have, like, these shows that were like Macross. They just wanted more Macross. And from the, and this kind of ties in how, with the kind of English fan base that would have known of Southern Cross because of, well, I'm going to say it now, because it was part of Robotech. I think their biggest criticism of Southern Cross is that it's not a good sequel to Macross. And I can't really argue that with that point, but I would say that that kind of logic is more like saying that Elgin was not a good sequel to Gundam, because, well, it was never intended to be. And Southern Cross was never intended to be a sequel to Macross. It is a follow-up to Orgas, more or less, which was, again, a follow-up to Macross. Again, obviously, they did kind of force a couple more Macross-y style plot points into Southern Cross, more so than, say, Orgas, but still, there was kind of that overarching plan that we're not going to make the same show or a sequel to it. We're just going to make the same kind of show. So, you know, and I feel that I'm going to do the little bit of the apology that I'm sorry that someone did kind of more or less lie to people, you know, a long time ago and tried to say that, yes, Southern Cross is a sequel to Macross, despite, you know, nothing looking the same or recurring characters not even looking the same or whatever they try to do with Robotech. And what I remember of the Robotech version of Southern Cross is that it is really the one that got changed the most. In fact, it has probably the most uniquely Robotech plot points, like the, you know, creation of changing Seyfried, who, a character I like, very straightforward, but they turned him into kind of this weird off-screen demigod as Zor Prime, clone of Zor, Robotech Master. It's like, I don't really care. And when he's mind-controlled, he doesn't speak in Southern Cross. So they had to have him speak in Robotech when his mouth wasn't on camera while being mind-controlled and, you know, going off about the Flower of Life and all this other bullshit that they kind of misinterpreted. And I heard there were some other problems because in the show, Xianu mentions having a younger brother at some point, and they kind of had to, they had just kind of straight up used that in the Robotech version. So they created a character that was never, you know, introduced before, and then other weird shit, and then they tried to, like, pass off that little girl from Janu's dream sequence at the end as another sister of Dana Sterling. It's like, I don't get it. Also, I gotta say, the first episode of, again, I have not seen Robotech since it was on Cartoon Network way back in the day, so I might be misremembering, but that first episode they did for Southern Cross, first off, it really has an audible clunk to it when they make the switch between the ahem generations. But the first episode for Robotech Masters, they actually made it. It was a clip show called Dana's Story, where they did scenes from another episode later on in Southern Cross, mixed with scenes of Maximilia, because in Robotech, they are Maximilia Sterling, the parents of Dana Sterling, who goes from having green hair, because it was Camellia in Macross, to having, you know, blonde hair in the Robotech Masters, but whatever. That whole episode is just basically somebody on the Robotech staff saying, man, we really wish we had more Macross to adapt. But hey, this character is totally, you know, the daughter of the characters you liked, the ones you'll never see ever again. But I'm sure you're going to like her, even though we make her incredibly annoying in this dub of the show, you know, and especially the way they kind of frame it in using the one scene from Southern Cross where Janu goes to see Bowie, and Bowie's in his room, and she kind of sort of busts in, but she's kind of polite about it, at least in Japanese, and then she kind of starts playing his guitar. I don't know where they got the scene of, like, where Dana Sterling is, like, playing the guitar, and she's like, la 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 la. It's like, because that isn't in Southern Cross, so I guess they splicing something from later on or something like that. But yeah, they really kind of make you hate this show off the bat, you know, whereas if you take Southern Cross by itself, it's a pretty good early to mid 80s mecha series. You know, it's just, yeah, it's just another one, but you know, it's pretty good. And like I said, I like the way the characters are. I like the robots, you know, I like the action's pretty good. It really doesn't do anything wrong. And to kind of echo Justin Tsivakis's review of it, the sort of quirky nature of the main characters as part of Squad 15 is kind of almost a prototype of Pat Labor, you know, where you have a colorful cast of characters who are robot pilots. You know, in Pat Labor, they're police officers, and here they're just, you know, the generic space army that, you know, every show has, and every space army in almost every space show has, they do everything. They cover all the branches of the military. But, yeah, they're kind of like this early Pat Labor crew. You know, they're kind of screw-ups, yeah. But, you know, they're competent when they need to be. And again, they have this sense of friendship and camaraderie that permeates the show. And I feel like this is a strength of the series. I will probably be rewatching Muspita at some point, or Orgus at some point, to talk about those shows. Because I did talk about Muspita on Disrael Podcast. I feel like I could maybe, like, have a different opinion on it with, like, a second watch. Because, you know, rewatching Southern Cross, I noticed some things before that I forgot about before. And, you know, I kind of had a lot of fun rewatching it. So this is my recommendation, that if you can find Southern Cross, I mean, I'm sure those box sets are still out there and they're still kind of cheap, but they did have a couple of problems, at least as far as quality is concerned. Because this $100 box set, and I don't know why they charged more for the show with fewer episodes compared to Muspita, had a couple of compression issues with, like, blocks appearing with action scenes. Didn't happen too often, but it was there. There's some interlacing issues in a couple of points during the show, and it's kind of really noticeable at times. One episode looks really bad as far as quality of the film. There's, like, a line running through it the whole time, and some scenes are kind of darker than they were before. So this part wasn't really that well preserved from whatever master they had left over. But overall, the quality is okay. It's kind of grainy footage because it isn't really digitally restored, but it is, you know, the colors are pretty much bright. They're, everything is clear. Nothing's really murky or anything like that. Yeah, and also there were some subtitle problems with the second episode on the first disc, where if you didn't, like, if you aren't watching it on, like, your computer or a DVD player with kind of a way to skip through it or kind of, like, just kind of jump around a little bit, it will get stuck on one subtitle. And they did mail out replacement discs. I bought mine secondhand, so I don't know if I could get that replacement disc. I mean, maybe I could, but at this point, ADV, you know, we learned they kind of went under and were reborn as several different companies. They don't have any plans to re-release Muspita and Southern Cross at this point. And I'm not sure if the combined box set actually had... they probably had the fixed subtitles, but I don't think they had any, like, fixes as far as the encoding goes. But really, of course, these things got marked down way, way fast. I mean, again, you can find them for, like, $20. And that's a pretty good price. You know, $20, 23 or 25 episodes. Yeah, that's pretty good. Or $50 for both shows. It's like, that's a competitive price. You can't sell these shows at $100 when few people are going to want to buy them anyway just because, you know, you're not marketing them that much. Other than, like, as trailers on your other DVDs, really. But, yeah, so you can find the show, definitely. I have to wonder if the Region 2 DVD is actually better. And actually, that's going to let me talk about some of the problems with merchandising in this show. While, obviously, Macross has a huge merchandising movement, Muspita had a smaller one, just kind of because of the anniversary of Muspita in Japan and, of course, Robotech in America. Although you'll notice that most of the Muspita toys that were ever made were sold on both shores. Except for the Asiems Corporation figures, which were done entirely for the Japanese market. And in fact, the Asiems Corporation line for Muspita is in fact the most complete Muspita toy line ever made. As far as good guy robots go. I mean, nobody's going to really be making bad guy robots. They barely make them for popular shows outside of Gundam. But with... Southern Cross, I noticed with the older box or model box, is that there's usually a sticker that tells you who authorized this merchandise. And while the box itself did say both Tatsunoko Productions and Big West, the people doing the merchandise sticker was just Big West. So I think what happened with this show is that Tatsunoko owns it because they produced it, and obviously they did the animation and everything was by their design studios, but because Big West was there as kind of for financing the show, and they apparently were the ones authorizing the merchandise, I think that the rights are split between the show. And this is still reflected on the R2 box set, where they have both Big West's name and Tatsunoko's name on the box. So what I think happened is that just because the show has the split between Tatsunoko and Big West, and these two don't like each other that much because of the whole Macross problem, that I don't feel like Big West is really willing to authorize merchandise for the show. And I don't think it's a question of exposure or notoriety, because Galvion, a show that has never been on home video ever. There are Raws out there floating around, and one got fan-subbed, actually, for Galvion that were taken off of TV, you know, a very long time ago. But the show that's never been on TV got reissued model kits when EMI models was still around, kind of in the early 2000s, you know, along with them doing Muspita and Orgus. And recently, a company called T-Rex, who has done computer-aided design work for Yamato Toys, made a limited-run, Wonderfest exclusive, transforming Circus 1/Galvion from the show. So obviously there's somebody still around that, even though the original makers of the Galvion TV series went under, somebody has the rights to that show, and somebody authorized this garage kit, or this garage toy, or limited run toy. And, you know, I really have a hard time believing that Galvion, again, never been on home video, is more well-known than Southern Cross, and, you know, in this world where almost every single show ever created eventually gets some kind of merchandise somewhere down the line. So I really just think it's a problem of just the rights split between the show, and that is what has kind of prevented even Tatsunoko and Harmony Gold by extension from making Southern Cross merchandise for Robotech, because they can't get the kind of both sides of the pond together on this whole thing. I mean, there was, back in the day, some awful Robotech toys of, you know, action figures, a Dana Sterling fashion doll, like a Barbie. I think they did want to make Jeanneau's hover bike, which in the shows are called the Flash Clapper. I don't think they made that. They did make a partially transforming Spartus toy, or, sorry, Veritech hover tank. which is the to this date the only toy of that design. And it can actually transform between all three modes if you modify it to do so, because normally it just does the robot mode and the kind of hopping tank mode. But, you know, there were never reissues of these. I think maybe there were reissues of these in the Exosquad Robotech line. Yeah, actually, I think there were. But, you know, these things just kind of faded away after a while. And nobody really wanted them because, you know, the Robotech Master Saga of Robotech is the least liked, even though, despite the fact that it has the most uniquely Robotech plot points out of all of them because of how much the show was chopped up to become, you know, the Robotech Masters, how much Southern Cross was chopped up. Because you have to remember, in Southern Cross, it's not even taking place on planet Earth. It's on a different planet that doesn't look like Earth at all, even in external shots. I mean, yeah, there actually are alien animals at some point, but I'm sure they probably cut those scenes or tried to talk over them why there are alien animals on Earth. I heard they actually had to remove the second moon of Planet Glory. But I guess it does appear in some scenes still, so, yeah. And obviously, you know, this is where, you know, characters will be repurposed as being, you know, related to other characters. You know, Jeanne became Dana Sterling, Emerson became Bowie Grant, nephew or something of Claudia from Macross, who in Macross, she's Claudia LaSalle, and, in Robotech, because, you know, being French is, you know, a sin, she's Claudia Grant. And I guess I've heard that basically every black person, or almost every black person in Robotech, is somehow a Grant. They are all related somehow because of this stupid muckery. Yeah, so I think that if there wasn't this licensing problem with Southern Cross, as far as merchandising goes, that they would probably make, you know, Siemens Corporation would probably make some Southern Cross merchandise. I mean, what says to me that they didn't do this when they could is the fact that when EMI was making these reissues of their Orgus, Muspita, and Galvion kits, they were doing the Southern Cross kits. So it's like, why wouldn't they do that? I mean, they did Galvion, like again, said that show was pretty damn obscure, at least as far as robot shows. I mean, robots that have merchandise are usually never obscure. Totally obscure, but they are more low-key than... So, yeah, it's like, Southern Cross does suffer from being the third entry in the Super Dimension series after Macross and Orgus, which I'm guessing by that point people were kind of tired of just having things that weren't Macross. They just wanted more Macross, which is why Do You Remember Love was such a success at the time. You know, as far as merchandise and as far as just popularity of the movie is concerned. And, you know, but these days people go to the mat, you know, for waiting breathlessly for, you know, a sequel or a remake of Muspita. Or they go to the mat for Gundam X, which is kind of the third in this little trilogy of alternate universe Gundam shows after G Gundam and Gundam Wing. You know, talking so much of how they thought the show was treated badly, but... there's nobody really there saying, it's like, you know, this Southern Cross is pretty good. Maybe you should check that out, too. And they're like, no, 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 it sucks. You know, even the Japanese said that Robotech improved upon it. I find that one quote that's floating around, I guess it was in one of the Robotech art books, to be a little highly dubious. Not that maybe somebody who worked on Southern Cross said that, but maybe they had said it in kind of that polite Japanese way that, you know, when people ask... Akira Toriyama about Dragon Ball Evolution, he just kind of says, well, I think they didn't quite do what, or I feel like they did a good job, or they didn't quite do what they should have done, or just kind of this very vaguely polite response about the movie that totally sucks, because, you know, I'm not sure that the Japanese people would really go for the or the Japanese staff really would be happy that the show was maligned into the least popular entry in, you know, this foreign version of the show. But yeah, you know, I gotta say, I like the show. I think it's pretty good. I think it's actually better than Muspita in some ways. Maybe a little bit better than even Orgus in some ways, because it, you know, both Orgus and Muspita kind of have episodes that aren't really necessary to the plot per se. But because Southern Cross is so short and because it was kind of a bit more focused, I feel like things came together, you know, even in the end when things were a little bit abbreviated and truncated because of the show being cut short. I would say that it's still, you know, it's a worthy 80s mecha show that I think you should check out. So next week, or next podcast, I don't really do this week by week, there's going to be a Halloween special, and we kind of talked about this in a previous episode, what it's going to be about. But yeah, so look forward to that. It's not going to be as long as this podcast, which I had to keep starting and stopping because of my bleeding dogs, which I love them so much, but they drive me nuts sometimes. So this has been Andrew for The Reef Show saying, you know, come with me on the Southern Crossroad, or Kudasu Road, or whatever they're saying in the freaking lyrics to the show. Sazan, Kudasu Road. It doesn't even sound like they're saying Crossroad. It sounds like they kind of mangled that a little bit. But anyway, this has been The Reef Show, talking about Southern Cross. Go check it out.